Session number 10885, reel 3.
Lillian Cadoux, reel 3.
For their disapproval.
Lillian Cadoux, reel 3.
When I got to the Wolverhampton Hostel, at last, I was in what you might call a permanent post. Up until that time, I'd been peripatetic. Filling in if other people were ill. Even the use of the word peripatetic indicates to me something slightly pompous about Friends Relief Service. That was their own term for it, you see. So, right, I eventually was sent to Wolverhampton, and around that time, this second relationship broke up. Again, I had been actually engaged with plans for marriage, but it all fell through. And I just didn't like this gap. So I think I carried out my duties as a nurse pretty conscientiously. I had had 15 months hospital nursing. But I wasn't prepared to abide by the general rules and regulations of that place. We had a shift system. There was one state-registered nurse and two of our sewer assistants. And I was vegetarian at the time. And we were always hungry because of rationing. We were always starving. And the cook used to keep the nuts in large tins and use them extremely sparingly, of course, in vegetarian dishes. And I used to sit and scoff them in the middle of the night. But in many ways, I very much enjoyed being in Wolverhampton. It was a large and beautiful house, which has remained an old people's home. And again, this is something I admire tremendously about FRS. They ran those hostels so well that in many cases they were taken over by the local authority after the war. And the style was kept on. For instance, we didn't let the old ladies just sit round the walls in armchairs, knitting and talking and staring into space. We asked them if they would like to help, no obligation, and the more active ones used to help prepare vegetables and feel they were part of the team, which I thought was really lovely. And we had a lot of fun. We used to, you know, because it was one of the bigger hostels and we'd got quite a large staff, we used to put on little shows for the residents and write the material ourselves and act it.
Who were the residents? Were they, you know, any particular group in Wolverhampton? Were they sort of deprived people?
They were bombed out people from Birmingham and Coventry. An interesting bunch. For instance, we had a blind married couple who weren't even old age pensioners. But because they were both totally blind, after all, they couldn't have coped with wartime conditions in the middle of a big city. We had a young man in his 20s, crippled, with spondylosis, for whom no other place could be found. So he had to live in this institution with maybe 40 old people. It was a very, very interesting place because, you see, having large grounds, we had a full-time gardener, an FRS man who was a vegan and had been for 6 years, so I used to cite this to people as in evidence that veganism didn't necessarily make you terribly weak. And, of course, at the same time, we got jolly good food in one way, all the vegetables absolutely fresh. And I could go to evening classes. This was important. I had a settled address. I was longing to do overseas relief work. I'd learnt French and German at school, and I could brush them both up, these evening classes. And incidentally get quite a lot of nice stimulus for my own mind. Because it was demanding and rather deadening, working all the time with old people. We had four of them together in a very large room on the ground floor, which we called the dormitory, for the simple reason that they were the most infirm. So, not surprisingly, after some months, the first one died. And this is a sort of known psychological fact. If that happens, the others tend to sort of mentally give up. And so that meant I nursed four of them through to their end within quite a short period, a matter of weeks. And I can remember sitting down at the kitchen table and just bursting into floods of tears because it was all too much. You get very fond of them and we ignore it. Four going within these few weeks, and the warden said, you need a weekend off. And I, who was a great enthusiast for the Youth Hostel Association, took myself off to the most beautiful manor house in Shropshire. And being young and resilient, a weekend was enough. Back I went.
It would sound as if you were ready for something more active overseas. I wondered if we could get on now to the sort of overseas part of your experience, Lillian.
Yes.
You know, how the opportunity arose.
Yes.
This presumably would have been towards the end of the war, would it, when Friends Relief Service became involved?
Yes. We had to have at least peace in Europe before they could possibly start where?
With your overseas service, you were saying about the conditions before.
Yes, well, partly because my relationship had broken up. That had had a very traumatic effect upon me.
I think you were saying about before the Friends Relief Service went, there had to be certain conditions.
Ah, yes, they had to have peace in Europe before they could possibly be allowed to send people in wearing Quaker grey. And I certainly was getting more and more impatient for this time to come. I'd been more than a year at Wolverhampton, so I was very, very pleased when I got the news that a space had come up for me on the training course at Mount Waltham. And I arrived at that place with very high hopes, found the training very, very fascinating. We had the occasional exceptional Quaker like Ruth Fry to speak to us, Corder Catchpole, Roger Wilson, people who'd been involved with FRS, FAU from many years before, perhaps even in the First War, certainly it was in the case of Corder Catchpole. And then on the practical side, you know, we had doctors teaching us about nutrition and diseases. We even had a week's camp in which we learnt how to prepare huge meals for refugees in field kitchens.
Would it have been men and women mixed?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry, I thought you knew all this from other people. Yes, I'd say the numbers were about equal.
Would you? You know, the proportion of women the same as men?
Yes, as far as I can remember.
Would that be the same throughout your experience in the UK? You know, your hospital work. Would there have been both men and women employed, or were you mainly women?
I would say there were more women. Quite definitely more, because male conscientious objectors could choose gardening and all sorts of other alternative work. But we still had plenty of men around. After all, each hostel had a male warden, in the sense that usually they were a married couple. Male cooks. Best cook I ever met was the male cook at the Woodlands in Wolverhampton, and gardeners. Oh, yes, I clearly remember many, many men even doing the ordinary household chores.
Yes, I was going to ask, you know, whether you were treated equally with the men.
Yes, the only job that the men did not carry out because they were not trained for it was nursing. Here again, that clear difference between FRS and FAU shows. Yes, there was very great equality.
But didn't you think there was equality in the FAU?
Oh, yes, yes, I'm not comparing FAU adversely, I'm just remarking, as compared with my civilian life, great equality of the sexes in FRS.
And this training, when you got overseas, did you find that it was adequate? That, you know, you had been well prepared for what you found when you went to Germany?
It's difficult to say, because we've left something out, which is my transfer from FRS to FAU. I was being trained for work with the Friends Relief Service. And at the end of that training course, I was sent for by a small panel of people in the personnel department of Friends House and told that they were very, very sorry I was not suitable to be sent abroad by them, because not only had there been certain adverse reports on me sent in by wardens of old people's hostels, but the warden of Mount Waltham had noted that I was out enjoying myself most evenings of the course. And I was far too taken aback by all this to think of telling them that when I got back from those evenings out, I had typed up my notes from the lectures of the day. And as far as I was aware, I was the only person there who did that because I was so interested and wanted to preserve them in really readable form. But I just had such a shock by being told this. I couldn't possibly have gathered my wits together. And in any case, I don't think I would have wanted to plead my case. I think I was aware that there were these really strong differences between me, with all my high ideals, but at the same time this frivolity and love of enjoying myself. Great basic differences between me and the French Relief Service. But nevertheless, I was absolutely shattered because this was something extremely important in every way from the point of view of my future career. At that particular point, as far as I knew, I was not going to be doing overseas work. So therefore, what the dickens was I going to do with my life? And during the time that I was on the training course, I'd become acquainted, not very much more, but become acquainted with Harold Cadou. I had kept my distance, actually, because the other women, knowing that he'd been a prisoner of war for 4.5 years, had rather flocked around him. And I'd thought, no, there is no way I'm going to join the queue. I can clearly remember when we'd had a weekend at home, people bringing him back pots of jam and things to help build him up. And I thought, not for me. But we'd been thrown together on this training camp.
This was the one for overseas?
This was the 1 week camp in which we learnt all these techniques for working out in the field. And I had been the person in charge of the first aid post, and he had a bad foot. So I just got to know him a bit better through that. And when I got back from Friend's house, most people had already left to go home on leave before their overseas service. And there's nobody in the lounge except Harold. And so I poured out all this utter misery and tragedy, as I saw it, to him. And he said, "What are you worrying about?" I think words to the effect that he didn't know why I was in Friends Relief Service in the first place. You can join the FAU. Which, of course, he was in anyway. And he said, "You can get a reference from Claude Catchpole," who was a great friend of his father. So that was what I did, and I was in the FAU within a very, very short time, about a week, I think. No, it wasn't as quick as that. I remember I had to sort of work out my notice. That's right. I went to help out in a hostel that was closing down in Potter's Bar. This was a nice little end piece for me in FRS because it was so interesting. The friends had set up homes for old people where they could be very self-sufficient, the Bernard Baron homes just outside of Eastbourne. And we were to conduct a contingent from this Potter's Bar hostel when we'd finished closing it down. So I had this interesting experience of travelling down seeing this prototype project, lovely little bungalows, each with their own bathroom and kitchen, and a warden's house to give them help and assistance if they needed it, and a central dining room. And during the time I was at Potter's Bar, Harold proposed to me and then went overseas to join his team in Germany. And then I went to work in Gordon Square because of my office skills, rusty as they were. My goodness, they were rusty, because, of course, I wasn't really a trained typist. I had simply learnt that as one of my many evening class activities. And they put me in the accounts department, and I worked with an extremely interesting bunch of people, and I appeared to be sort of secretary, because I did a lot of work for Robin Whitworth, he who'd worked for the BBC and was a first-rate man for public relations. So I used to type lots and lots of his letters pleading for donations. And I got to know the outlines for working with the Red Cross under the umbrella of the United Nations very well. But lots of times I couldn't read back my own shorthand, and I was always ringing him up down the corridor to ask what he'd said after a certain phrase. And also the very, very interesting part about this piece of service was many of the FAU men were coming back from very far-flung places like Ethiopia and China. And I was given the job of taking down their accounts in readiness for the book that Tegla Davis was going to write. And I remember hearing the story from Richie Bouncy of the young FAU man who had to perform a cesarean operation in Ethiopia, and his friend held the book open at the right page and turned them over as he went along. And how enthralled I sat listening to Perry Jones tell about his experiences in China.
Is that what happened? You know, they were sort of interviewed for this book and it was taken down in written form. Is that right?
They weren't even interviewed.
They just spoke about it, did they?
Just spoke off the tops of their heads.
And you wrote it down, did you?
Took it down in shorthand and then typed it up. Theo probably interviewed people.
That's a very well-researched book, isn't it?
Yes.
The Tegla Davis. I know I use it a lot myself.
Yes. But you see, Perry Jones is a Welshman. Do you know him? Have you met him? Are we on tape or off? Perry Jones has that golden tongue. Tegla Davis knew what he was doing when he put Perry Jones and me in a boardroom and just let Perry talk. He didn't need interviewing. The experiences those men went through were so vivid and life-changing, and they were almost always extremely well-educated, intelligent people. And we didn't have tape recorders in those days. So it all worked out very well.
So going into the FAU after the FRS, what was that like for you, Lily?
Oh, I was so happy. You could wear lipstick and you could go to dances. Now, Quakers do try so hard not to look disapproving, they look pained. For the best of reasons, because the time and the money that you are using on these enterprises could be better spent. And I got fed up with people looking pained. And I honestly didn't mind a scrap about wearing khaki. I just didn't care. I was a pragmatist. I wanted to get on with the job, and the red crosses on my shoulder tabs were quite enough for me. I think I even quite enjoyed in Germany the contact that we had with the military, because this gave the opportunity for a dialogue, which a lot of the unit men found happened during the war as well. So I had to wait some 6 months before a place was found for me in a team in Germany. I certainly did get impatient at times.
You hadn't told me whether you said yes or not.
Ah, well, that was why I was so impatient, because I had, funnily enough, I had said yes and added the words, "I know I shall be taking an awful risk." Because already I understood to some extent, you know, what those wartime experiences had done to Harold. But anyway, by this time I was head over heels in love with him, so it didn't matter. And, of course, I was not only anxious to get out and be working in the field, but I was anxious to get over there because we were going to get married over there, because Harold, of a somewhat shy and retiring nature anyway, and probably much less wanting any publicity after those POW experiences, had decided that we should be married in Germany. That meant that it was with the least possible fuss, no trouble about finding an outfit, just wore your uniform, got on with it. In fact, we had a rather strange experience apropos the marriage, because we had the FAU headquarters for Northwest Germany in Flotho, with dear Mike Roundtree at its head. And he and Enid Cowling actually arranged our wedding. The Judge Advocate General should have married us, because he's entitled to, like a captain is on a ship. And they'd booked a reception for us at a local hotel. And we had had to drive many, many miles to get there, about 100 kilometres, and found, when we arrived at the office in Flotho, that the wedding had been postponed from midday to 2 p.m, because the Judge Advocate General had been called away for some important case. So we had to go and have the wedding reception because it was booked for 12:30. And I felt such a fool. I mean, people make little speeches and things and you feel jolly stupid sitting there without your ring on yet. But anyway, it was all very heartwarming, and you had such a strong feeling of being part of this FAU family. And that is a feeling that actually never, ever leaves you. Because when Enid Cowling became gravely ill about 1.5 years ago, I, who had had no contact at all with her between that time, 1946 and this, felt impelled to write to her and keep contact, you know. until her death. So in the event, we were married by a brigadier who looked extremely embarrassed, quite an elderly man, had never done it before, and sort of mumbled through in such a way that I felt rather disappointed. You know, he hadn't made much of a ceremony out of it. And in fact, of course, we had two weighty friends as witnesses, Mike Rowntree and Eric Cleaver. And Eric made some sort of little speech, some kind of Quakerly address, I think, to ameliorate the situation.
That's somewhat ironic, isn't it, being married by a general? Two pacifists.
Very. And we could have been married with great pomp and ceremony at Cologne Cathedral. But again, I didn't know. I hadn't heard about it. Because there was another couple...